Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. The ways climate change is changing our planet is too long to list. Some communities are grappling with sea level rise, others with drought. Historic ranges for plant and animal species are shifting with ripple effects across ecosystems. And as ecosystems change, so do our means of growing, raising, and distributing food. For thousands of years, citizens of tribal nations have adapted to numerous changes, from ice ages to sea level rise. Citizens of tribal nations have also shown remarkable resilience in the face of colonization and the loss of ancestral land. While the speed of human-induced climate change is unprecedented, the wealth of knowledge about adaptation and resilience within tribal nations is vast. Today, we talk about the climate change challenges faced by citizens of tribal nations, and joining us is Dr. Casey Thornbrew. He's a citizen of the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe and former program manager for the Climate Change Program in the Office of Environmental Resource Management of the United South and Eastern Tribes, known as USET. He's also co-founder of Just Collective Consulting. Welcome to the program.
Kui kwasin, Mindy. Katapatash for inviting me. Natasuis Casey Thornbrew, Gana Domas Masipia. My name is Casey Thornbrew, and I am a citizen of the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe. I live in Mashpee with my wife and two children. I've lived home for recent years. My mother, Cheryl Green, grew up along with my uncles here in Mashpee. I grew up away from my community, but I've returned as an adult, living here now and working to have my children be close to our community.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about the work of USET.
So USET was founded by four tribal nations in the late 1960s, specifically 1969, the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians in North Carolina, the Seminole Tribe of Florida, and the Miccosukee Tribe also in Florida, as well as the Mississippi Band of Choctaw Indians. These four tribal nations came together to recognize the need to address the issues and concerns of tribal nations, particularly east of the Mississippi in the U.S., and recognizing that these were often overlooked. And rather than, as many tribal nations have to do, a kind of a one-on-one with the federal government to make sure the federal government's trust and treaty obligations are met, these four tribal nations came together to say, you know, why don't we form a intertribal, multi-tribal organization to go to Washington, D.C., to address the concerns and to support one another. USET's motto is strength in unity. And as the organization established itself, other federally recognized tribal nations over the course of decades joined USET. To where it is today is USET is made up of 33 federally recognized tribal nations. And the geography of USET is from the far northeast woodlands, so areas like, again, New England area, all the way down to the Florida, the Everglades, and across the Gulf Coast to tribal nations that are part of USET are located as far west as Louisiana and Texas. And USET has different parts to it, but one of the largest parts of it is technical support for its member tribal nations. And the technical support occurs in assisting tribal nations with health and public health work and priorities. Also providing technical support to tribal nations in the environmental space. And that's kind of where I had the great opportunity to work for 7 years as the climate program manager in the Office of Environmental Resource Management. USET also provides technical support in the economic development space for tribal nations. It's a 501c3. There's also the C4 side of USET, which is the advocacy space. USET regularly speaks and comments on issues impacting tribal nations, not only in the USET region, but also on a national stage as well. Through changing administrations and through things such as impacts from climate change to the issue of missing and murdered indigenous women. So
Covers a lot of ground, right?
absolutely, absolutely.
You also mentioned you're co-founder of Just Collective Consulting. What is that?
So Just Collective is a home business that my wife and I started in the fall, using both of our experience in the natural resources, climate, and working with communities, particularly frontline communities. We work in the space of also technical support and climate adaptation. We also provide presentations and consultation and working with organization, whether it's community-based organizations or organizations that work with communities on ethical engagement, items and issues to consider, for example, when working and partnering with tribal nations. We do a lot of education on that. And then we also review, work with organizations that have projects with communities and with tribal nations, again, reviewing their materials to make sure, everything from, ethically said done well, but also providing comments on like how to improve and what other items can be thought of in such projects.
I think people might be surprised to learn how many tribal nations in the eastern and southern part of the U.S., which you just mentioned, many. Explain how tribal nations functions within the United States and the rights that their citizens have.
Yes. So what's most important is that tribal nations have inherent sovereignty. And we say inherent because sovereignty wasn't given to our nations. It has already existed as long as our nations have existed. But we've had to work very hard to maintain that sovereignty as the United States grew and established itself. And many of our tribal nations have treaties with the United States. And that's mentioned in the US Constitution. And so we say that it's very important to know and understand that tribal nations have inherent sovereignty, and we are sovereign nations within a nation. When I share this, I talk about especially the many, many treaties that the United States has with tribal nations. The United States has many communities, many cultures, extremely diverse. But when treaties are made, the assumption is you are making a treaty with sovereign nations. So what I hope to see in developing, education, especially in the K through 12, is more education on tribal nations, especially through civics instruction on that, because I'll say my educational background is in geography. So I'm a geography all the way up through my PhD, or maybe I can say the 23rd grade. So, but in any case, in geography, students are expected to eventually be familiar with the 50 states, be familiar with the United States, federal governance, state level governance, and municipalities. A lot of times, students don't have access or aren't given information to tribal governance unless electives are taken in Native American studies or things like that at the college level. But what's important for people to understand is the United States, there are families of government, and three in particular that are very important to always remember. Of course, is the federal government, there are state governments, and then there are tribal nations. And so ideally, we want folks to understand that, just as people may be aware, hopefully aware of where states are located and some of the priorities in different states, they're just as familiar as the location of tribal nations, especially in their own region,
Yeah.
and some of the priorities of these tribal nations.
And I think a lot of people are not aware of that, whether they're school age or not. And as we know, tribal nations were forced to cede their land during the 17th and 18th centuries. So give us a sense of how much tribal land remains in the southern and eastern parts of the U.S., and how much tribal land remains here in the Cape and Islands.
Sure. So a lot of when we say tribal land, we have to think of a couple things. We think of probably the most important thing is that, all of North, Central, South America, every square foot inch of it is tribal land or the ancestral homelands of a particular tribal nation or particular tribal nations of particular regions. As you had stated through history, there were cases where tribal nations ceded lands in a treaty, and due to situations where leaders of tribal nations acting for the best of their people decided, rather than go to a war or rather than other higher risks, doing these treaties and ceding lands, but then holding some lands for the continuance of tribal nations and communities. And then other situations where tribal nations didn't cede lands, but nevertheless a war or an invasion actually happened anyways. And so what we have today is, definitely like a geographic patchwork of tribal trust lands. And trust lands are lands held in trust by the United States federal government, for tribal nations to govern, assert jurisdiction. In education, we think sometimes they're often referred to as like reservations. You said we usually say trust lands more often, but so these are usually smaller parcels of land, smaller than a tribal nation's original ancestral domain. But nevertheless, areas where the tribe has jurisdiction over its natural resources, its education. Tribal nations have their own school programs, and so on and so forth. In the United States, it's about as tribal nations, many have been successful in getting land back and having those lands put back into trust. And thus growing the land base or regaining the land base. But it's on the order of about 2% across the United States. That actually bumped up to near 4% back in, I want to say a few years ago with the Supreme Court decision. That acknowledged that many of the tribal nation lands in what is now Oklahoma were not abolished by Congress. And therefore, even though Oklahoma was established a state, the original reservation lands of the Cherokee Nation and Muscogee Nation, for example, technically still remain tribal reservation lands and jurisdiction. And so you had like cities like Tulsa, Oklahoma, being okay, it's part of the state of Oklahoma, it's part of the city of Tulsa, but it's also jurisdictionally part of the Muscogee Nation. So, in conclusion, it's still a fraction of tribal nation, lands for direct jurisdiction. But when we see in the east, again, east of the Mississippi, the number or the acres or square miles of land that tribes have in trust for direct jurisdiction is tends to be much smaller than tribal nations in the Midwest and out in the West. Where we have in the Northeast, the range for federally recognized tribal nations in the Northeast are land holdings from a few hundred acres to some tribal nations are on the path to get back about 30,000 or so acres of lands and have those back into trust. But still, something that on a geographic scale of, say, looking at the states of New England, you're not going to be able to ascertain that they're dots,
Yeah,
and looking at that.
866-999-4626 is our number. If you'd like to join our conversation, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about the climate change challenges faced by citizens of tribal nations with Dr. Casey Thornbrew, citizen of the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe and former program manager for the Climate Change Program in the Office of Environmental Resource Management of United South and Eastern Tribes, known as USET. Also, he's co-founder of Just Collective Consulting. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. In Massachusetts, tribal nation citizens have hunting, fishing, and gathering rights. Before we talk about the threats from climate change and all that, talk about these rights and the significance, both practically and culturally.
Yes. Thank you very much for mentioning. So, as I mentioned earlier in our conversation, tribal nations and communities have inherent sovereignty. We also have inherent Aboriginal, we refer to as Aboriginal rights, hunting, fishing, gathering of medicines from ecosystems and spaces and waterways. The majority of the majority of tribal nations never relinquished those hunting, fishing, gathering, or Aboriginal rights. Even in cases where tribal nations may have ceded lands, the ability or the means to access those lands to sustain ourselves and continue our culture were never relinquished. And so this is especially true in Massachusetts as well. Mm-hmm. We talked about lands where we have direct jurisdiction and things like that, and trust lands. But Massachusetts, and I recall it's, I think, in the late 1970s and also early 80s, acknowledged that tribal communities within the state of Massachusetts continue to have these rights and continue to be able to, again, go to spaces in our homelands and waterways to, again, sustain ourselves and continue our culture. We've seen those challenged in decades, in the Northeast, but also the West Coast. Saw similar issues where tribal citizens would be fishing and then would be accosted or arrested for fishing, and that all also went to the Supreme Court and was known as the Bolt decision, which acknowledged that where a tribal nation has not explicitly relinquished hunting and fishing rights in what is called usual and accustomed places, those rights still exist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And tribes across the country also refer to that and look to that. And we do here in the Northeast. So I will say one challenge to that on a practical level is accessing mm-hmm. these spaces. So we're on the Cape Cod Islands. And one thing I'll say about being here is, it's, there are coastal communities, but there are also, resort vacation communities, so on and so forth. And what has happened is exceptional development on the coastlines and just back-to-back private property and so on and so forth. So these usual and accustomed places that tribal citizens and our ancestors would regularly access are become less accessible. We started to really see that in the 1970s onwards as we had this development. And so we have these inherent Aboriginal rights, but on a practical level, if a fence is put up or if stones are placed on pathways for that tribal citizens may have used to access the waterway or place like that to shellfish, that these are obstructions for tribal nations to continue our Aboriginal rights, and in many ways to continue our practice and cultures.
Then we also have the changing climate threat, right? So fish, wildlife, traditional foods, even places of cultural significance are under threat from a changing climate. As the climate warms, migration patterns of species are shifting and growing seasons are changing. So let's talk about some examples. Ocean temperature changes and fish migrations. What changes are we seeing in what species, and how does that impact citizens of tribal nations?
Sure. So, especially on the East Coast and in particularly the Gulf of Maine, these are in some areas where we're seeing the fastest warming in the oceans across the globe. When we think about species, and a lot of tribal and indigenous cultures, we refer to them as our relatives, and meaning that the presence of our relatives, or biologically speaking, these species, is very important for our culture and for our world. And every indigenous nation in the Americas or across the world, it's very much tied to our identity. And that's why we see, like, again, in looking at the Pacific Northwest, there are so many that would consider themselves like, salmon nations, or very, very closely connected to that and to the culture. And as we see this warming, particularly in the surface or skin level of oceans, where a lot of these species are, they're moving and they're changing their patterns. My tribal nation and community, one thing that's really important to us are river herring, and we've seen physical obstructions to river herring in Massachusetts with the establishment of dams and changing of normal waterways and passage for river herring to come up and spawn. But we're seeing warming oceans and warming lands and waterways impact the timing of when river herring come up. And river herring are important, source of food and related to, like, to our culture, but they also signify our renewal or new year when they come up in the spring. And so a lot of cultural activities and ceremony and so on and so forth are around this time. So when you start to hear from people who fish and who are spotting herring, like, much earlier, like in March or others, and it's kind of starting to throw things off a little bit. Also, when we get into the ocean space, more the open ocean, timing of certain species like bluefish, striped sand, or striped bass, excuse me, it when they come up or are staying in areas longer, or more presence of, like, black sea bass, a species of warmer water conditions lasting longer, and then the presence of species in colder water areas not being as available, that's definitely impacting food sources. And I'll mention, like, the American lobster as another example. Back in the 1960s or so, the biomass of American lobster was really, concentrated, like, Long Island and Cape Cod. And people would think, like, Cape Cod, I'm gonna get a lobster, there's, like, so many and everything. Although, yes, people still fish lobster in Cape Cod and Long Island, but people do not see as much as they did, or harvest as much as they did in previous decades. The biomass of the American lobster now is in the Gulf of Maine. So, I mean, it's still good for the Maine and Nova Scotia lobster fishing industry, but we're seeing that the biomass continue to move north into colder waters. I'll conclude by saying one of the challenges is that, as I said earlier in our conversation, tribal nations have trust lands that we have fought to protect. And in some cases, these trust lands have even been threatened in recent decades. My own tribal nation, our trust lands were threatened in 2020, with that. And so we're doing everything possible to like hang on to and protect the our homelands and jurisdictional areas. And we have these inherent Aboriginal rights in our original ancestral lands and waterways. But as species are moving away, species that can are moving away from our lands, it makes it really hard to access and continue these. And in some cases where species or our relatives that aren't able to move or adapt, we see less of them. I want to just point out one quick example that I found while working at USET was tribal nations in the space of Maine, for example. Some may be familiar with the Maine Indian Land Claims Settlement Act of 1980, which established the formal federal recognition of tribal nations in Maine and also restored some tribal lands. Well, for some tribal nations in Maine, what is fortunate is that the return of lands, although still making a fraction of the total state of Maine, are in different ecoregions. And so that allows for a little more possibility of resilience. And for example, if you're a tribal nation and you have some ancestral lands in the conifer forest ecosystem, you have some tribal lands in the coastal ecosystem, and as things are moving, you just that's like I said, you have a little bit more ability to maintain contact and use relatives in over different space, but not all tribal nations have that situation, so.
Yeah, and as you're mentioning, you're seeing changes like you mentioned the lobster that are moving and species and even plants that can move. But there's also invasive species, right? Warmer winters. Earlier this month, we talked about how warmer winters are benefiting the non-native green crab because the bays and estuaries are no longer freezing over. Talk a little bit about how this changes the cultural practices for native people, because those green crabs seem like they're, I mean, they're especially in the Gulf of Maine, the Gulf of Mexico, I mean, they're very plentiful and getting more so, right? So how does that, what kind of impact does that have?
So it definitely impacts again the availability of native species and relatives that we would rely upon for food and in many cases sometimes are oftentimes say our economies as well. I've seen my tenure actually prior to working for USET, I served as the director for the Natural Resources Department of the Mashuapanok Tribe. And one of our biggest initiatives was reestablishment of oysters and oyster reefs in the Papanesid Bay. And one we did face those challenges of like where we had juvenile oysters being subject to the green crab predators that are going through and sometimes it's kind of like an uphill battle. And we had like we had green crabs and then we have presence of blue crabs also in the bays and blue crabs being native species and a food source. But green crabs maybe not originally but are here now. With regards to what are referred to as invasive species. Tribal nations and tribal natural resource and environmental agencies, of course, recognize the presence and sometimes more prominence of invasive species in our homelands and waterways. That leads tribal nation, natural resource and environmental agencies to think about, okay, what does the management look like? And what do we do about these beings? And it's really interesting. While working at USET, I had the opportunity to collaborate and partner with other intertribal organizations and tribal colleges, also dealing with climate change. And we had discussions about invasive species. And so one particular organization, the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, or GLIFWC, which has in partnership with the College of the Menominee Nation and the 1857 Treaty Organization, a tribal adaptation menu for tribal nations to use to develop climate adaptation plans. And they refer to invasive species as non-local beings. And they use the Anishinaabe language. So it puts a different spin on it a little bit, because I think in Western natural resource management spaces, there's like been first, can we eradicate? Can we like eradicate this invasive species? Or is it more prominent now that eradication is not possible? Now we
Right.
have to live with it. I think tribal agent environmental natural resource agencies are also on that, but looking at like, okay, this species, this relative is here now. What's its relationship to the other beings and relatives? How can that be managed? Kind of looking at along those lines. And I think as we think of food sources moving with a changing climate and warming and changing waterways, one of the things in our meetings is it's shown the importance of tribal nations working with each other on that. And especially, one of the things is in our case, say tribal nations in the space of Massachusetts, working in regular communication with tribal nations to our south and to our north, on these new beings are in your space, and this is how we've lived with them, or this is what we're doing, and how sometimes even our traditional foods are going to change a little bit, and sharing that, and that's what we call sharing indigenous knowledge with one another.
Yeah, good to be, like you say, to be able to have that collaboration with each other. Let's talk to Tor, who's giving us a call. Hi, Tor.
Oh, good morning to you, Mindy, and to the gentleman here from the Wampanoag. I'm curious, starting at Nauset Marsh in Eastham, where I used to work for the Museum of Natural History. In a float boat, we'd cruise over the marsh at high tide, and then we had a glass-bottom boat so we could watch the bass swim right under the boat. So in Champlain's day, and if you go to the Museum of National Seashore, you can see how their exhibits try to pinpoint the tools that were used for fishing to get the fishing resources to the people who lived in what wigwams and lodges right there on the dunes. And then in terms of global warming or climate change, then we see that the Henry Beston House is no longer there on the outskirts. And so the changes happen. And then how and what tools? I'm curious to know. For paleo people who were there first, what tools did they use for the actual collecting of fish and shellfish and so forth?
All right. Thanks for the question, Tor.
Sure. So yeah, when we talk about tools, I like to use the term traditional technology. One of the things about indigenous communities and our communities in particular is we optimize resources or things that were close to us, whether it's plant materials and others. We have histories of, I think people would refer to as like a fish weir, like today, where our tribal communities would citizens way back in the day could build areas to kind of funnel fish to where we wanted them to go, to make it easier to fish and collect them as well. These technologies allowed us to continue to do this. And today we have a balance of using traditional technologies, but also contemporary things available to us to gather to shellfish, fish, so on and so forth. Something that came to mind when we were talking about our homes, our wikiwash, or wiki, which is what the home structure that the gentleman was describing. Our life ways also allowed us to live in the spaces that we live in. And so Wampanoag, which is where we Wampanoag folks, the traditional word to refer to ourselves, often had seasonal homes. And so we would have villages close to the water, especially during the warmer months and summertime, because it made sense to be there and to have access to fish and shellfish during that time. And then these villages would be not completely taken down, but just the necessary items, and we would move inland. And it made sense to be away from the water during the winter and during the more stormy time of year, and to find shelter in forest and kind of valley areas. And then the summer returned to areas where our villages were. And so our modern society, we have our homes and we've got to kind of stay put there. Although granted, many people do vacation and kind of go back and forth, but for us it wasn't necessarily a vacation, but it was a life way.
866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about climate change challenges faced by citizens of tribal nations with Dr. Casey Thornbrew, citizen of the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe and former program manager for the Climate Change Program in the Office of Environmental Resource Management of United South and Eastern Tribes, known as USET. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Under the Biden administration, there were increases in federal funding for tribal climate change resilience. How does the, I mean, you're looking at long-term planning and you have different administrations coming every 4 years. Talk a little bit about how that impacts your long-term planning. And do you have the fundings part of the time and then it's taken away another time? And, what are your concerns now?
Yes, whether it's climate change resilience and adaptation, or any other major priority of a tribal nation, the pendulum of changing administrations and changing folks in Congress as well impacts our ability to sustain long-term programs. And especially, it's especially important in climate resilience and adaptation. We're seeing changes now, but we are also looking at the projections of what changes are to come about, given various plausible scenarios on the next 50 or 100 years. In my tenure as the program manager for the client program with USET, we often utilize federal funding or assisted tribal nations to obtain federal funding to establish climate adaptation plans or and or climate vulnerability assessments, which are often precursors to plans. And establishment of these plans was a major step. But once you have these plans, you have to implement them. And you need the funding, steady funding and resources to implement them. It can be very difficult for a tribal nation to establish and maintain over long term a climate office or climate resilience office. Tribal nations usually do the climate resilience work within other offices, like the environmental, natural resource, or sometimes even the culture and historic preservation offices, or emergency management, as other examples. This year, and this the intro into the current administration has been exceptionally challenged with like funding freezes, which These are funds already obligated by Congress, whether it's for tribes to do natural resources work or community and social services work, the individuals to do the work have been hired or ready to be hired, or the contracts to do the work with other organizations are there, and it's definitely a shock to the system on that. Tribal nations have to be very agile, I would say, in climate adaptation planning. And so, although there are tribal nations that have climate adaptation plans, and probably there are about over 70, I'm going to say, right now, across the United States, tribal nations with formal adaptation plans. But adaptation planning also has to occur within larger strategic plans of tribal nations, emergency management, natural resources, economic development, so on and so forth. So every year that moves along, that's often the case where you have tribal nations considering, like, whether we have a formal adaptation plan or not, how do we factor in climate change and a changing climate and the things that we and our priorities going forward? If funding is not available, one of the things we have to do is think about being agile. And although federal funding is a trust and treaty obligation for the United States, if it is not being met, we still got to find ways to do the work.
So how is federal funding for climate change resilience and adaptation determined? Do tribal nations have to compete with other state, local, and nonprofits for the same pool of money?
Well, what so one of the when we talk about funds, so tribal nations, like I said, the funding from the federal government is a part of the trust and treaty obligation, but unfortunately, it remains to be discretionary funding. And so in that sense, on a larger scale, yes, we are competing with so many other sectors in the United States for funding to support our resources and priorities. There are agencies that have particular funding and resources and support, such as the Bureau of Indian Affairs, BIA, but also other agencies, historically, but also in recent years, through my tenure, such as EPA and NOAA, have provided funds to support, including tribal nations, for adaptation and resiliency work, or even climate action planning for tribal nations to do an assessment of our own carbon footprint. No, and those kinds of things. So there's that competition. During my tenure, one of the issues we voiced from USET is for support, federal funding and support for tribal nations to be more fair and equitable. Because even if you have a substantial amount of funding for tribal nations in the space of climate change adaptation, that funding, like I said, is originally it's discretionary, but it's also competition based. Basically, if you are a tribal nation and your department or agency, if you don't have a grant writer or development officer to pursue competitive funding, it's a challenge. And so many tribal nations have that challenge and are facing situations where they need to try to contract with somebody to pursue these grants. And so we don't see it as fair, just, and equitable across the board of tribal nations, and in some cases, we are competing with each other for funds.
Rick writes, with genealogical records poor in the past, have the indigenous people ever conducted DNA tracing to establish their tribal heredity? And has the tribe accepted the relationship of wind for energy versus fossil fuels?
So, when we think about our identity, and I say our identity, so I want to be mindful, like, not as to speak for every indigenous person and things like that, which is not appropriate. But some tendencies, if I may, just tendencies is Western science does really, like to hone in on DNA and the origin of human beings and people and so on and so forth. Our origins are very important to us, but our traditional knowledge, our stories, our family relationships, kind of take priority in identifying like who we are and how we know who we are and where we're from, and so on and so forth. So, in my experience, I'm in my in my 40s now, I'm, I have a science background, but like internally, DNA tests and things like that, I haven't seen tribal nations jump at that, say, hey, let's use that to, say where we're from and who we are. We know that. Those inquiries usually come from the outside, from outside tribal nations, and things like that. I think the second part, I'm sorry, I'm trying to remember.
Wind versus fossil fuels, yeah.
Wind versus fossil fuels. Okay, so I had a lot of experience with this, especially during the Biden administration, and basically, every tribal leadership that I was in contact with, or that spoke out on offshore wind and development, was on the same page on, yes, climate change is happening. We need to reduce fossil fuels, and find more renewable energy options. That was, people were on the same page on that. But what was being asked was working closely with tribal nations on responsible offshore or renewable energy development, and respecting if a tribal nation, because we talked about our lands, but also our waterways. If a tribal nation said no, we don't want to have these on our homelands, then it would be respected. And or where a tribal nation would could say yes, but we need to consider A, B, and C factors to do it responsibly. The last glacial maximum, 15,000 to 20,000 years ago, produces sea levels hundreds of feet lower than what they are today. And so these places that are currently underwater or offshore, were dry land, particularly south of, as we recovered in the glaciers here on Cape Cod and things like that. Areas to the south were above land, and our ancestors lived in those spaces. And so our cultural landscape continues over the seascape and over the bathymetry of the bottom. And that's why on land, when you would develop a place, you have to do like environmental assessment, but also consider cultural impacts, working with local tribal nations. Tribal nations also want that same level of respect and work and working in marine space for the development. So that was my experience, especially during the Biden administration. It was moving very fast and not with adequate consideration for tribal concerns.
Dr. Casey Thornbrugh, citizen of the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe and former program manager for the Climate Change Program in the Office of Environmental Resource Management of United South and Eastern Tribes, known as USET, also co-founder of Just Collective Consulting. We'll have a link with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Thanks so much for taking time to being with us today. We really appreciate your thoughts.
Patapatosh, thank you very much for the invitation, and so pleased to be here with you today, Mindy, and audience. Thank you.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.